Welcome to AgriPulse Newsmakers, where we aim to take you to the heart of ag policy. I'm Spencer Chase. Our guest this week is Feeding America Chief Government Relations Officer Vince Hall, who joins us to discuss the impact rising food prices are having on the nation's food banks. But first, here's this week's headlines. The Biden administration is requesting another dispute settlement process with Canada over the country's dairy policies. U.S. Trade Representative Catherine Tai says American officials are seeking to challenge Canada's dairy tariff rate quota allocation measures and its decision to release quota months at a time instead of on an annual basis. Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack says Canada has failed to honor and implement the commitments it made under the U.S.-Mexico-Canada agreement. Also on the trade front, President Joe Biden announced on Monday the new Indo-Pacific Economic Framework. The IPEF includes 13 Pacific Rim countries and is expected to lead to a reduction in non-tariff trade barriers, but is not anticipated to lead to greater market access for U.S. products through tariff reductions. Experts say the framework is aimed at reducing China's influence in the region, but many American ag groups say tariff reduction is ultimately going to be needed. And finally, the Department of Agriculture released new figures projecting a big increase in grocery prices this year. The new food price outlook from USDA's Economic Research Service projected a big price increase between 7 and 8% this year. The boost is led by eggs, which are expected to be about 20% more expensive over the rest of the year. Dairy, beef, poultry, and fruits and vegetables are also expected to experience price hikes. Feeding America operates a network of food banks that touches every county in the country. When we spoke with their Chief Government Relations Officer, Vince Hall, we asked him about the role increased food prices are playing at those banks.
Well, quite simply, it's having a devastating effect on the nation's food banks on both the supply side and the demand side. The demand for food from the Feeding America food banking network continues to increase. We never saw a significant decrease from the pandemic heights. And in the last month, 65% of our food banks report seeing increased demand. So this means consumers who are living on, barely making it each month, are having a really hard time. And the increased food prices are driving more of them to food banks to help make sure that their families are nourished. And then on the supply side, Feeding America food banks are purchasing more food than ever before because of disruptions in the supply chain, decreased donated food products, decreased federal commodities coming to food banks. So they're having to pay those higher prices every month, and it makes it ever more difficult to help families close the gap between what they need and what they can afford.
You touched on something there that I wanted to circle back and ask about, because sort of just on a food bank 101 level, if you and I were to walk into one of your more distribution center size facilities and look at what's on the shelves, are we looking at more so purchased food or donated food?
You're looking at the highest percentage of purchased food in the history of the Feeding America network. The truth is that when the pandemic hit, the supply chain became very taxed, very tight, and the availability of donated food, which has been bread and butter of Feeding America's work for decades, was severely constricted. That happened, of course, at a time when demand significantly increased as the economy shut down, families were having trouble finding food. And the good news during the pandemic was that the federal government and private donations to the Feeding America network both caused a very, very quick increase in funding and commodities available to help address the crisis. The crisis we're facing now today is that the federal commodities have been reduced by over 30%, so we're getting less help from USDA. Donations to Feeding America food banks are down, so our capacity to purchase food is decreased, and we're still seeing extraordinarily high demand at distributions. So to close that gap, food banks are spending more money than ever on that purchased product, even though those prices are increasing every month.
Mm-hmm. You say that it's the highest percentage of purchased food. I mean, can you put a figure on that in terms of what percentage of food Feeding America is buying now as opposed to receiving in donations as it had been previously?
Well, in some of our food banks, the percentage of purchased food has reached 30 to 40%. It varies from region to region as availability of state-provided commodities or the availability of donated food because of a local food producer or access to local farms varies across the country. So it's a significant challenge for us because monetary donations are down, federal commodities are down, donated product is decreased, and it's really, really difficult for food banks to go from month to month trying to budget what they're going to need to serve the community when the prices continue to go up, not just on the food, by the way, but on the cost of transportation, on the cost of electricity to keep those coolers on, to keep those cold storage units on. Food banks are doing more fresh produce and healthy proteins like meat and fish and chicken than ever before. But all of those healthy foods require sophisticated transportation and storage systems that are powered on electricity and gas and diesel that are requiring us to spend ever more money on the cost of transporting both purchased and donated food to our warehouses and then out to our 60,000 plus faith-based and charitable organizations that distribute that food to the community.
We'll be right back to discuss the upcoming White House Food, Hunger, Health, and Nutrition Conference, as well as the 2023 Farm Bill with Feeding America's Vince Hall right after this.
It's not as simple as just to wake up one day and go, I want to be a conservation farmer. You're changing how your farming practice is done. You're changing your operation.
Farm Credit supported John and Kelly Watley as they shifted to more sustainable farming, improving the environment where they farm and live. Learn more at farmcredit.com/climate.
Welcome back. It's no secret that food prices are increasing, and Feeding America's Vince Hall says that's having a real and tangible impact on the demand for Feeding America's services. What does the demand picture look like now for Feeding America compared to perhaps, you know, it's difficult to compare to the last couple of years, but maybe compared to pre-pandemic levels of demand?
Yeah, well, Feeding America food banks have provided 11 billion meals to people in need since the start of the pandemic. And the demand that we're seeing across the network is expressed in the number of food banks who report increased demand at their distribution. So 65% of our food banks in the last survey reported that they saw increased demand over the previous month. The vast majority of the remainder of the food banks reported sustained the same level of demand at food distributions. But food distributions vary in the way that the food reaches the community. Sometimes it's a twice a month distribution at a church pantry. Sometimes it's a congregate meal program serving seniors. And sometimes it's a drive-through lane in a COVID-safe way that helps families to get access to boxed food. But the methodologies and the locations mean that people can access the food in a way that is most convenient for their family, that is done with dignity, and where possible, maximizing the choice of commodities. But it doesn't give us a precise census of how many people are coming to the network each day. We really rely on the trend, and the trend is that we're seeing more people than ever.
Mm-hmm. Well, while I got you, I also want to touch on some other issues, including the discussions about this upcoming White House conference on food, hunger, health, and nutrition. Wondering, you know, from the chair that you're sitting in as a Feeding America leader, what do you hope the White House learns from that dialogue?
Two things. One is that we're hopeful that the White House will succeed in its attempt to unify the whole government and business and other sectors around a strategy to end hunger. It is unacceptable that there are 38 million people, including 12 million children in the United States, that are struggling with hunger. We actually throw away more food in this country than is necessary to solve hunger. So to bring all the instruments of the federal government together, to task every federal department with playing a role, to bring together leaders from business, from agriculture, from charitable sector, civic leaders to map out and implement a strategy to end hunger in this country is essential and long overdue. The second is that we're very hopeful that the political leadership in Congress and the White House will also recognize that we are heading into a new and serious hunger crisis this year, that the rollback of COVID augmentations to federal nutrition programs like the SNAP program and the TFAP program, that the sustained high level of demand that we're seeing at food banks, combined with the things we just talked about, like inflation and supply chain disruptions, are putting this country in a transition mode from a pandemic emergency to a hunger emergency. And we're hopeful that the discussions happening as early as 2 weeks from now, leading up to the final conference session in September, will highlight not just the need for strategic long-term planning around solving hunger, but an immediate crisis response plan to deal with the crisis that's immediately in front of us.
Well, and on the immediate front, obviously the best thing that could happen would be for food prices to, you know, fall off a cliff overnight for consumers. That would obviously be a big help for consumers, for food banks, for a lot of folks. But that's not going to happen overnight. There are what would you say are the other more immediate steps that could be taken as opposed to a long-term view? What can be done quickly to address this issue in your mind?
Well, we should take the lessons of the pandemic and apply them to ongoing policy. There are things that happened during the pandemic that helped to really prevent a very, very critical increase in hunger in the United States. Just to give you an example, the pandemic EBT program recognized that when school gates are closed and kids are locked out of school nutrition, an EBT card can help that family have the same purchasing power to replace that lost nutrition at the grocery store when the school gates are locked. And there are, you know, 22 million kids in this country that depend on school-based nutrition programs. And only 1 out of 6 of them have access to those programs during the summer months. So if we could take the pandemic EBT card program and translate that into a permanent nationwide summer EBT program, then in every community in the United States, whenever the school gates are locked for summer break or for extended winter break or what have you, those kids would still have access to the nutrition that they were getting from the school cafeteria. We saw with waiver flexibilities on the SNAP program that it became far easier to get qualified people enrolled in the SNAP program so that they could purchase food to feed their kids. And that includes things like digital signature or telephonic enrollment meetings. But creating needless and bureaucratic obstacles to participation in SNAP only hurts the people who are the intended beneficiaries of the program and makes the cost of the administration of the program higher. Instead of putting money into food that helps feed people, we're putting money into bureaucracy. So there are many examples where we can take lessons of the pandemic and translate those into permanent policy decisions that help empower people's access to healthy and nutritious food.
Mm-hmm. Lastly, and quickly here, Vince, obviously the 2023 Farm Bill, just around the corner, hearings are being held on that subject these days. Wondering, how do you expect the current food price framework, the current demand framework for Feeding America services, how do you expect that to inform the discussions around the nutrition title of the upcoming Farm Bill?
I think it's critical that policymakers pay close attention to what's happening to ordinary Americans all across the country. And through the field hearings that are occurring and through the meetings that people who are experiencing hunger are having with elected officials, we have to create policy structures that are responsive to the real world and not just proceed on the momentum of what came before. So we recognize that the Thrifty Food Plan update, which occurred through the 2018 Farm Bill, was a very significant and important step forward for both the SNAP and the TFAP program. And it is essential that we preserve the authority of the Secretary of Agriculture to modernize the Thrifty Food Plan as the way people eat changes. It doesn't do us any good to lock in rigid structures that aren't adaptive to the evolutions of the way people prepare, cook, and eat food in our society. So the Thrifty Food Plan update to SNAP and TFAP was a major win of the 2018 Farm Bill for families facing hunger, and it improved access to food, which helps our agricultural sector. So we need to protect that authority through the 2023 Farm Bill, and we need to make sure that as we discuss access, the availability of SNAP and TFAP to communities, that we're listening very intently to the voices of people who are facing hunger and crafting our policy agenda around their needs and the opportunity that we have to solve hunger.
Mm-hmm. Well, what an opportunity that would be to actually solve hunger. So many challenges, so many obstacles between now and then. But Vince, we appreciate you stopping by and informing us on the current state of affairs at Feeding America.
Thanks for having me.
We'll be right back to hear from our panel. But first, our Hannah Pagel takes a look at some of the reasoning behind that big spike in egg prices in this week's Ag by the Numbers.
Since the first confirmed case of highly pathogenic avian influenza in February, producers have had to take precautionary measures to prevent the disease from spreading further. The virus can spread very quickly, which is why USDA's Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service depopulates flocks at operations where infections have been detected. The outbreak was slow to spread in February, but by March, the number of high path cases increased rapidly ahead of Easter when U.S. egg producers often expand their flock sizes to meet the demand for the upcoming holiday. More than 180 commercial flocks have been impacted, with most of the concentration hitting the Midwest, specifically the state of Iowa, which is the number one egg-producing state in the country. HiPath impacted more than 13 million birds in the state, with Nebraska and Pennsylvania having to depopulate over 4 million birds. This chart shows us the flock sizes of egg-laying hens over the last 5 years. The red line shows us the impact HiPath has had on this year's flock sizes, which was already smaller than in pre-pandemic levels. During the largest HiPath outbreak in 2014 and 2015, the industry lost 43 million egg layers, which can be seen by this blue line. According to the latest Consumer Price Index, egg prices shot up over 10% in April, which was the largest single increase for any food category in April. Prices for chicken also rose over 3%. For this week's Ag by the Numbers, I'm Hannah Pagel.
Farmers are always there for each other. We shed tears together. We celebrate together. But we also grow together. Farm Bureau is the largest general farm organization in the country. We have the farmers back. If you're a farmer and you're not a member, we would welcome you into our Farm Bureau family. And if you want to know more about agriculture, come be part of this great family.
Thanks for joining us for more AgriPulse Newsmakers. Glad to be joined by a panel now to go deep, really, on both the domestic and the international hunger issues facing the country, facing the issue of hunger and keeping the global population fed. Excited to be joined by a number of experts, including Brandon Lips with Caprock Strategies, Kip Tom with Tom Farms, and a former World Food Program and Food and Agriculture Organization official from the United States, as well as Andrew Shane with the Food Research and Action Center. I appreciate you all joining us. And Brandon, I want to go to you first because borrowing on your expertise, your years working in the nutrition programs during the Trump administration, wondering what you can see as we see these food prices go up. What has there traditionally been in terms of a relationship between the price of food and the need for food assistance?
Sure, Spencer. Thanks for having me on today. Thanks for talking about these important subjects. Certainly, the relationship between the amazing job that our farmers in this country around the world do to supply food, not only for Americans, but all of those who need to eat around the world, and the relationship with our domestic feeding programs is very close. As you look at the myriad of feeding programs that we have in this country, ranging from SNAP to TFAP, which provides food to food banks, school lunch, certainly, as food prices start to increase, as we see inflation across the board, families' budgets begin to tighten very quickly, and they try to figure out where they can shrink spending. Unfortunately, a lot of families look to do that on the food front. Where can I spend less on food? Where can I buy cheaper food? How can I stretch what I feed my family? And that's when they turn often to their local food banks. Some families who are on SNAP and need to stretch their budget, but certainly those families who aren't on SNAP or other benefits and they just need some help making it through the month. So we do see a significantly increased demand on food bank during these times.
Well, and Andrew, that kind of leads into the question, Brandon's point there leads into the question I was about to ask you, which is that as we look at some of these issues, we look at more expensive food, we look at sort of a stagnant SNAP benefit, it hasn't fluctuated a whole lot, there has been the thrifty food allocation, but your thoughts on more expensive food, the stretching of that SNAP benefit, and what that means in terms of real hard impacts to the nation's food banks?
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I appreciate the comments that Brandon made, and this is something that we're seeing across the country. You know, if you just look at the data being put out by the census, food insufficiency has risen pretty consistently over the past year, and then the rising food prices are obviously compounding that. And then when we look at SNAP, I think, you know, it's pretty clear that the benefit, unfortunately, is not adequate to last the month. And it really points to just that underlying inadequacy. The Thrifty Food Plan was very helpful, long overdue increase, the first such increase in more than 40 years. But we know that more could be done to make sure that folks have enough to eat. Even with that increase, SNAP benefits average about $5.50 a day. That's just not very much when you think about you know, the rising cost of food. And in fact, it's about 30% of, actually, I think it's up to about 38% of households who are accessing SNAP are also relying on food banks. So just once again, showing that the benefit is not lasting the month. Folks are having to stretch those resources by going to food banks. And it's just the overall strain on the emergency food system and the need for more action in this space.
Well, and Kip, we've talked a little bit so far here about the domestic hunger issues with things like SNAP and the nation's food banks. But internationally, obviously seeing the war in Ukraine putting a strain on the nation's and the world's ability to feed itself, particularly in some vulnerable corners of the world. I mean, we've talked about this with you previously, but I guess what is the latest in terms of how we're seeing that the Russian invasion of Ukraine impacting food security around the world?
Well, we know today that there was negotiations that just concluded in the last couple of days with Moscow trying to relieve some of the sanctions on Russian fertilizer to allow for a humanitarian or blue channel out of some of the Ukrainian ports to meet the needs of the World Food Program and other countries that are in dire need of the feedstuffs and food products that come out of Ukraine. We know that was unsuccessful. So today we know the ports continue to be bombed, up to 250 sorties a day going into Ukraine, rail, roads, infrastructure issues. We know that there's issues with the EU and Brussels and slowing down the transfer of some of these grains out of Ukraine into Romania to be exported. So there's a number of issues, but we need to remember this. The Arab Spring we witnessed back in 2007 through 2010 will probably pale in comparison to what we're going to see here in the near future. This is the first time where we've had a country that not only produces food, but the linkage to Belarus and Russia and the lack of access to fertilizer is going to affect the global supply chain in producing food around the world. So this is going to have a direct impact on those that can least afford it the most. And that doesn't matter whether it's the United States or in a developing economy. This is of epic proportion.
We'll be right back to talk farm bills, SNAP, and Ukrainian trade issues with our panel right after this.
Looking closer, seeing further. That's how we do it. At Curious Plot, we're driven to find what's next for agriculture, animal care, and food. We stay curious because that's what it takes to grow understanding. That's how we plot strategies and tell stories that get results time after time. Marketing, communications, and consulting that look closer and see further. Curious Plot. We can't wait to help you tell your story.
Welcome back. Food prices and hunger issues have obvious and immediate ramifications, but what is the long-term view? We asked our panel to discuss. I want to bring things back home here for a bit because, Andrew, obviously we're looking at the conversations around food and hunger, you know, obviously a very immediate concern. But as we look forward a little bit, the 2023 Farm Bill, not all that far away, and there's hearings taking place on it already. There's discussions going on in terms of what the need will be in that policy. Wondering what you would anticipate in terms of potential farm bill implications from the current situation that we're seeing with high food prices and a swelling demand on the nation's nutrition programs.
Yeah, that's a great question. And as we know, some of those hearings have begun and those discussions are well underway in the community. Because, you know, families who are on the front lines are saying loud and clear that they need assistance, that they are facing food insecurity, and they're looking to, you know, Congress and federal policymakers to act. You know, looming over all of this is also some of the temporary COVID provisions. So there is actually a significant benefits cliff looming in SNAP for most of the states and territories of about $82 a month per SNAP recipient when those provisions end. Outside the farm bill, but very relevant for this discussion, is the more immediate cliff that families are facing in terms of access to summer meals and school meals next year related to the non-extension of waivers unless Congress takes action. And so there's going to be a lot of focus on the access to SNAP, on improving equitable access, on benefit adequacy. And I think that was already reflected in the first hearing that the House held, and a lot of interest to make sure that, you know, we're doing everything we can to leverage the federal nutrition programs to fight food insecurity.
So obviously, as we hear all the time, the administration implements the Farm Bill, but Congress writes it. In the interim there, Brandon, you know, if USDA wanted to take some additional actions to address some of the hunger concerns that are being observed right now, what levers are there for the federal government to kind of pull on this issue to if they were looking to provide additional assistance outside of something like the Thrifty Food Plan update that they did in response to the 2018 Farm Bill?
Sure, Spencer. USDA does have some flexibility, certainly, in when and how they make purchases to assist food banks in providing those benefits and making sure that that supply chain is working. I think one of the big challenges that USDA is going to have as we move forward, if you put what Kip said together with what Andrew said, not only is there a question of having adequacy of benefits, which is a discussion that will always go on with SNAP and other programs, but really making sure that that food supply is available. If you look at what just happened in the infant formula realm it's not that Americans didn't have access to adequate WIC benefits, it's that the formula was not available on the shelves. I think there's concern around the country and around the world that in the long term that supplies of food are going to get tighter and tighter, and the access for folks to have that food to share with low-income Americans through these various programs, as with all of us, is going to be very difficult. I have the honor of sitting on the National Midwest Food Bank Board, who serves over 2,100 food pantries throughout the country, and they're reporting that right now the demand at their food banks is actually higher than it was in the height of the pandemic in 2021, and the volume of donated loads that they're receiving is down. So big concerns that we need to watch carefully, and I know USDA is working hard to make sure that they manage those.
Well, and on the food supply front, Kip, I acknowledging that there's a lot of hypotheticals I'm about to throw at you, but if we accept the hypothetical that potentially an agreement is reached on this humanitarian corridor tomorrow, I mean, there's still ports that have to be demined. There's still grain that has to get into the supply chain. It's a long time between the Ukrainian farm and the ultimate destination. What kind of a lead time do you think a recipient of that Ukrainian grain could expect, you know, if and when this humanitarian corridor were to overcome all of the various geopolitical hurdles at play?
Yeah, it's months. I mean, let's face it, the grain in the country, in Ukraine, the grain bins are full. The ports are full. The ships sitting at the ports are full. They're ready to be shipped. You have to demine. You have to bring in security patrol. I know there's some talk about the Turks providing some of that security, but the reality is we don't even have an agreement yet. And so we haven't even started flowing. You know, the Russians keep bombing the roads and the rail. The Ukrainians keep rebuilding, but at what point in time are we going to be too late? I mean, we got countries in Africa right now across the entire Sahel, from Nigeria to Somalia, that are, some of them are down to 20, 30 day supply of wheat or wheat flour. This is why, you know, if we can't count on the opening of those ports, we need to make sure that we have a U.S. agricultural system and other developed agricultural economies around the world have the reliability and durability of our systems. And this is why I keep talking to congressmen saying we need to bring back more of our supply chains from places like Russia, Belarus, and China and India. We need to bring more of those supplies back to the United States so we have the ability to feed that growing world.
Well, it's a shame that this conversation is only a 10-minute conversation, because there's probably a dozen questions I could ask all three of you again. But I think we're going to call it a day for now. But Brandon, Kip, and Andrew, appreciate the time today. We'll be right back with more AgriPulse Newsmakers. But first, our Hannah Pegel speaks with someone who has decided to step away after a career in farm policy in this week's Featured Farmhand.
A longtime DC farmhand won't be adding another farm bill to a long list of legislation he's helped guide across the finish line. American Farm Bureau Executive Vice President Dale Moore announced earlier this year that he plans to retire after more than four decades in farm policy. But before that happens, we sat down with Dale to discuss the lessons learned throughout his career in our Meet the Farmhand series. He shares how his cowboy roots prepared him for a career working with politicians, and he reminisces of stories working at USDA with four different secretaries of agriculture and on the Hill with Pat Roberts, including this one.
And was fortunate after another job to get a call from Mr. Roberts indicating he needed an ag guy. And when I went in to interview with him, I was like, you know, Congressman, I don't know a whole lot about politics. And he kind of laughed. He said, buddy, I grew up in politics. What I want is somebody when they're sitting on the wagon tongue talking to me about what's going on their farm, they're going to say something like, you know, Congressman, you know, I can't turn the, you know, my stalkers out yet because wheat hadn't hit the third tiller stage. And I'm going to nod my head sagely, turn and look at you and say, what did he just say to me? So I said that that opportunity to go to work for a man who needed an ag kid and he could handle the politics, and I said, I've been blessed ever since.
Moore also shares the plans he has for retirement and the advice he'd tell himself if he could go back to day one of his career. Head to AgriPulse.com to watch his full Meet the Farmhand interview. For AgriPulse, I'm Hannah Pagel.
Did you know AgriPulse has all your favorite podcasts, including Open Mic, Newsmakers, and Drive Time? Take us wherever you go. Subscribe at AgriPulse.com or on Spotify, Google Play, or Apple Podcasts.
Agriculture Future of America is a nonprofit building transformational leaders in food and agriculture. AFA prepares college students to join the workforce as innovative and engaged young professionals who will shape the future of agriculture. Head to agfuture.org to find out how you can get involved.
Thanks again for tuning in for another episode of AgriPulse Newsmakers. Before we let you go, here's what's on the horizon for the week to come. We'll be keeping an eye on the Environmental Protection Agency and watching for news on the upcoming renewable volume obligations. EPA is required by a consent decree to announce final biofuel blending targets by Friday, June 3rd. On Thursday, the Commodity Futures Trading Commission will hold a meeting on carbon markets, which CFTC is billing as its first ever voluntary carbon convening. There's certain to be more to follow during the holiday week as Washington gears up for the summer legislative season, and you can keep an eye on what we're working on at AgriPulse.com. For AgriPulse Newsmakers, I'm Spencer Chase. Have a good one.
Newsmakers is a production of AgriPulse Communications. For more ag policy news, visit AgriPulse.com. You can also find our new content on YouTube and wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget to follow AgriPulse and our correspondents on social media to get breaking news and more.